Good afternoon, everybody. I am going to try to cover a lot of information in a relatively short period of time. I'm not going to assume that everyone in this room knows what situational crime prevention is, so I'm going to begin by giving you a broad overview of that so you have the context with which to interpret the remainder of this session. Then I'm going to be focusing on three different NIJ-funded evaluations that have both applied situational crime prevention concepts, and they're in various forms of evaluating the impact of those applications. Trying to tie it all together, a lot of lessons learned, both for practitioners and for researchers who undertake this kind of work. So we'll hopefully have some good discussion at the end. Just real broad brushstrokes, although this isn't rocket science, and it always stuns me because I think it's just such common sense. It's really based on microeconomic theory. It assumes that most offenders aren't really motivated to commit crimes. They don't wake up in the morning and say, I'm going to rob a bank. Yes, those people do exist, but most of the people who commit crimes are committing crimes of opportunity. They walk by and see a situation where, you know, maybe it's a door that looks ajar or something like that. They take advantage of those opportunities. They also weigh the costs and benefits of engaging in criminal behavior. And those costs include the risk of getting caught, right? The risk of apprehension, how much effort it takes to engage in the criminal act, and then the benefits are, well, what they hope to gain from it. And it could be monetary gain, or it could be some other kind of gain. Like, you know, a lot of violent acts, the gain is sort of status among one's peers, for example, be it juveniles or in a correctional setting. So situational crime prevention says, given that theory, we can change aspects of the environment and aspects of potential criminal targets to alter that cost-benefit ratio in a way that closes off criminal opportunities and discourages a lot of those would-be criminals who didn't wake up in the morning dead set on committing a crime. This chart on the right-hand side just gives you a lot of examples of ways that you can increase the effort or risk and reduce the rewards and also remove excuses of some of those low-level criminal activities. Oh, I didn't know I was breaking the law. Post the laws more prominently. So those are just some examples right there. So with that as the backdrop, I'm going to describe three different evaluations. The first one is looking at crimes occurring in the D.C. area, metro, the subway system, we call it metro here, in the parking facilities. And I want to acknowledge my project director, Samantha Lowry, who did the bulk of the analysis for this presentation. She's not here today, but she's here in spirit. So why did we decide to look at this issue? Well, frankly, it stemmed from my doctoral dissertation when I was looking at crime occurring in subway systems, specifically looking at Metro as a case study because it had always been held up as this great example of this good design that closed off criminal activities, that was managed very well, et cetera, but no one had set out to look to see whether that was true. And in the course of doing that research, what I learned was, yeah, crime is really low on the rail, but above ground, crime is relatively high. Most of the Part 1 crimes are occurring in the parking facilities. They're mostly auto thefts or auto break-ins or sometimes other parking-related crimes. And, you know, that's the bulk of the problem, the crime problem that Metro was facing. And so we reached out to the transit police and we said, would you like to partner with this? It's an action research partnership, which means that we were involved in the beginning to set out to understand what the factors were behind these crimes and how could we together develop a series of interventions that could close off criminal opportunities, and then we would evaluate it along the way and see if there was an impact. So that was our goal, to do a lot of research looking at historical data, doing site observations of the parking facilities, trying to identify all the environmental and management characteristics that seem to be related to crimes occurring there, identifying strategies. And then this was a randomized controlled trial design in that there were 52 parking facilities. We ended up looking at just 50 and randomly assigning the intervention to 25 of those 50.
And I'll tell you a little bit more about that later. We used a lot of different data to try to understand the nature of this problem, and we really need to look at not just data that was maintained by the transit police, but also the data for all the law enforcement jurisdictions that serve Metro, and you know, it's a pretty big system, and so that ended up being seven different jurisdictions where we had to go and ask for crime data. So we looked at Part 1 crimes within a mile radius of the Metro station. We looked at a lot of administrative data on sort of the nature of the parking facilities, what their capacity was, how full they were. There's a lot of different factors that I'll describe in a moment, including these site observations where we went and we made note systematically of all the different characteristics that we observed, whether there was fencing around the facilities, whether there's one exit or two, was there an attendant booth or not, was the attendant booth stationed, et cetera. This is just some of the highlights from the site observations. Most of them had payment facilities where you had to pay upon exit. We saw that as a very good way to prevent auto theft. If you have to pay to exit, you need some kind of demonstration that you've got the parking ticket that you received when you entered the system. There were some places that had multiple exits that made it more difficult to monitor the facility. We looked at the surroundings, and as I showed you already, we looked at above-ground crime rates that in the surrounding jurisdictions. We looked at whether or not they had attendant booths and the degree to which there were actual humans in the attendant booths and many other things. So given all of that, we came up with a long laundry list of interventions, and some of them were really creative, and one by one they all got shot down. Either they weren't feasible practically or politically, and sometimes both. So what we ended up doing is rather mundane. It was to install cameras at the exits of half of the randomly selected facilities. In addition to the cameras, we put prominent signs that said, you know, your car and your license plate could be captured on camera. And we said could be because, you know, we didn't want, there's liability issues. You have to be very careful with the language that you put on these signs because then you don't want people to assume that they're somehow protected and if the camera malfunctions, they're not. But they were very prominently placed. Even though a lot of these facilities had challenges with both auto thefts and car break-ins, mostly this intervention was aimed at auto thefts because there's only, you know, most of these places, there's only one exit. We positioned cameras so that they were at the exits. You know, you're going to leave. You're thinking that you're going to be captured on camera. You don't know whether they're going to capture the license plate or you behind the driver's, in the driver's seat or both. You know, you'd think that that might make a difference. But we were also hoping that that would also sort of send a message that Metro cares, that they're looking in other ways, and it might even discourage some thefts from autos, some car break-ins, right? The intent was to link, the cameras had an ability to record. The intent was to link that to some license plate recognition software that they already had in place. During the course of the intervention, the auto theft unit was disbanded. We have yet to locate a human being who can tell us whether or not they're using the cameras in any way. So this could be an evaluation of the bare minimum of, like, put the technology up and hope something, you know, makes a difference, because it's probably not human interaction with that technology. So this slide just tells you a little bit about how we did the random assignment. Since we only had 50 parking facilities, that's not a huge end to work with for random assignment purposes. And even if we were to flip a coin each time and decide for each 50, do you go in treatment or control, we couldn't ensure that those two groups would be equivalent. So what we did first was to create matched pairs on a lot of different factors. Once we created these pairs based on historical crime rate in the surrounding area, the capacity of the facilities, their payment policies, and so forth, then for each pair, we assigned them to treatment or control. And that method was designed to ensure more equivalency between the two groups. So I wish I had more exciting findings to share with you, but this is one of those lessons learned that I think we'll talk about later on, and that is that all the things that can go wrong when you try to engage in this kind of evaluation work in the real world, where staff changes and policies change. So we knew originally that when we did our analysis to understand the factors that were driving the auto thefts and other types of car crimes in the facilities, that the data was not maintained as well as we would like. So how many of you have been on Metro, familiar with the facilities? Some of you not, well, yeah, fair share. So in some places like Shady Grove, you've got multiple parking facilities. You've got parking lot A, parking lot B, you've got a multi-level garage, whatever. There's a lot of different options for parking. And when events occur, you sort of want to know where, right? We were counting each of these facilities as a separate entity. So within Shady Grove, of the three facilities, you know, two could be in treatment and one could be in control. So we'd really want to know the location of the events. We made a lot of efforts to ensure that officers were recording that data very well at the onset of the project, and then came to learn that they changed their MIS system. They changed staff, and the auto theft unit who we were relying on to make sure that they were recording this information well was disbanded. So now when we're looking at post-intervention data, we have a lot of data where we don't know what facility within a larger station area experienced the crime. So we're like, oh, great, all this work. What we did so far was to look at five match pairs where there was only one parking facility, so we knew exactly where it happened. Even with that very narrow analysis, it looks like we've seen a bit of an impact on crime. It's really too soon to tell. We really need to aggregate across all 25 treatment and control facilities, but it looks like it could have made an impact, could have made a difference. And we're in the process of developing a strategy where we can estimate the location of those crimes in those situations where you have stations with multiple facilities. So that is, see, I told you I had a lot to share. I've got two more studies to share with you. But we promised we'd do it all, didn't we, Winnie?
We did.
So hold those thoughts, because I'm sure there's a lot of burning questions. And then I'm going to move on to our safe city evaluation, which is another application of situational crime prevention. But it didn't really start out that way. It started out by the Target Corporation. Everybody knows Target, right? Approaching us because they had this crime prevention program called Safe City. It had a lot of great packaging. I mean, like glossy little folders that you give to communities, and it was designed to encourage law enforcement to partner with retailers and mall environments, and in together to engage in crime prevention activities. But the Target's original focus was really on, we're going to help you make these partnerships, then we're going to quickly leave. We don't want to control this crime prevention activity. But we will give you a big blown-up check, you know, for the photo op and the press conference and so forth, so that you can spend money on something really cool like CCTV technology. And so a lot of jurisdictions said, oh, this is cool. We can get money to buy cameras. And Target wanted us to evaluate it. And we said, well, what could you pay us? And they couldn't pay us anywhere near what it cost to evaluate something. So we said, well, why don't we partner and go to NIJ and see if we can get funding? And they said, okay. And then we looked at their materials and we said, there's nothing to evaluate because there's no real it there. You know, there's like money for technology. What if we started anew and identified some sites and worked with you and developed more of a model that's based on theory, say situational crime prevention, and then together we help jurisdictions implement it? And so that's what we ended up doing. We selected four sites: Chula Vista, which we'll hear about in a moment, Cincinnati, Ohio, Tucson, Arizona, and Hyattsville, Maryland. All of them have their own unique stories. But just to give you some background about why, the way we were looking at this, we were looking at this as a retail crime issue. As you can imagine, shopping malls, most of these were malls, strip malls that were anchored by a Target store. They present a lot of opportunities for crime because they're designed to attract people, right? I mean, that's part of the business model, is bring people in, make it attractive, make it accessible. You want to be on a transportation network. And all of those factors also make it attractive to would-be offenders. Malls are also places where shoppers can easily be distracted, so it's a good opportunity for pickpocketing. It's a place where people park their cars for, you know, an hour or more, so their cars are unintended for a significant period of time, which leaves them vulnerable to break-ins or even thefts, and all kinds of crimes end up occurring there. So we wanted to document the process of retailers partnering with local law enforcement to implement Safe City. We were viewing this again as action research, where we weren't just these Ivy Tower evaluators who were over here waiting until the end and saying yes or no to the intervention work. Rather, we were there every step of the way. We were interviewing stakeholders. We were trying to understand better whether they were moving forward on their initiatives, whether they were adhering to the fidelity of the model, and giving them feedback so they could improve along the way if they were able to. And so then we guided them on strategies and evaluated the impact. This is just a lot of the common strategies that are used in retail environments, but I don't think I'll read them out to you because I feel like I'm already out of time. So I'm just going to talk about the kind of measures we used. We looked at the types of meetings that occurred, the topics that were covered, the composition of the meeting attendees. We looked at the types of interventions that were employed. We did surveys with businesses both before and after the Safe City intervention. And in the meantime, as part of this action research role, we also prepared a series of guides that we could share, not just with the sites we were evaluating, but also with the larger community. So we have a bunch of very practically oriented guides that target kindly put into a very nice-looking format that is better than what we tend to do at the Urban Institute. And they printed them out, hard copy. We were able to distribute them to the sites, and hopefully that provided some good guidance along the way. So in terms of the impact measures, we looked at both perceptions of safety based on these pre- and post-surveys. We looked at level of communications and whether they increased over time, whether crime reporting increased over time, and then we looked at more of the hard impacts on the types of crimes that they were trying to reduce. So what did we find? We found that two of the sites never really got off the ground. And those two sites had problems pretty much from the outset based on the fact that they never really followed the model. They were enamored by that big blown-up check concept and really had set their sights on using the money to buy cameras and hadn't gotten the right people around the table, the right stakeholders to engage in, you know, what is the nature of our crime problems, you know, how do we want to address them. There was no real problem analysis to understand what crimes were occurring as reported crimes. They didn't interview any real retailers. They really didn't do any of that work that needs to happen in order to get buy-in for an intervention. And so for various reasons, neither one of them really got off the ground. Cincinnati was successful. They found an impact on increased perceptions of safety. More retailers were likely to report crimes. They also saw a total crime reduction in their areas. It wasn't huge, but it was cost beneficial. We did have a cost benefit component to the evaluation. The thing about Cincinnati was they were already engaged in this huge crime prevention effort before Safe City and the Target Corporation stepped in. So it's very hard to identify cause and effect, whether that would have they would have achieved those crime reductions anyway. Chula Vista, however, is our poster child, which is why Captain Wedge is here today. They really embraced the model of looking at the nature of their crime problems, trying to understand what was causing them. They saw good results in terms of their surveys, increased perceptions of safety, reduced concerns about crime. Unfortunately, we were unable to detect real significant reductions in the kinds of crimes that they were trying to reduce. We did see reductions in robberies, but we also saw some increases in property crimes. But the thing of this is, and something that I want to talk about later if we have time, one of the problems with any kind of rigorous evaluation is that we always have this endpoint of our evaluation, even if the intervention is ongoing. We had to stop. I mean, I don't know, we were probably on our third no-cost extension as it was. What do you think, Winnie? You know, it was like we were out of time, we were out of money, we had to just say, okay, this is the evaluation end date. And I'm not so sure that our story is the right one. As a matter of fact, I think from what you'll hear from Captain Wedge, they went on and analyzed it further down the road, and they did detect a significant change. These are some of the challenges we encounter when we're evaluating things. And, you know, we work pretty closely with Chula Vista PD to help interpret our findings and present them in a way that everyone felt good about. To just summarize this Safe City evaluation, both Chula Vista and Cincinnati were more successful because they already had a strong grounding in community policing. They already had some good collaborations in place between law enforcement and the retailers. They weren't fixated on one silver bullet response. They weren't thinking CCTV. Actually, Cincinnati was, but they were thinking of it as part of a much larger crime prevention strategy. Chula Vista actually felt almost pressured, I think, by Target to implement CCTV, and they said, no, that's not the way we want to do this. And I'm sure we'll hear more about that soon. So I think that there's reasons why we saw some success there. And the other two sites, as I already explained, they just weren't really following the model as intended. Some implications that we learned from this project. One is that it really needs to be led by law enforcement, but not dictated by it. It had to be a partnership and an authentic partnership with the retailers and the other members of the community. And that requires a lot of communication. The problem solving, you know, I'm calling it situational crime prevention. A lot of us call problem-oriented policing. There, I find the two to be closely aligned, if complementary, if not overlapping strategies. And that problem solving was real key in developing responses that would be effective. And then we already talked about evaluations that become derailed by a lot of different things, including local politics, which certainly came to play in Tucson. And we talked about the confined evaluation period already. So, two down, one to go. And this is a more unique application of situational crime prevention. As far as I know, there's not a lot of examples of evaluations in correctional settings. Richard Wortley wrote an excellent book on the topic of, you know, theoretically, how would situational crime prevention be applied in correctional settings? But I think this is the only published evaluation of it. And what we did was set out to look at reducing sexual violence in three jails. Now, this was funded with Prison Rape Elimination Act money that was through NIJ. So, of course, we were expected to focus on sexual violence, which, of course, we did, understanding that the rates of reporting of these acts are extremely low and unreliable. But we felt that theoretically, if you look not just at those rare events, but also looked at in the larger context of violence and infractions, we could still develop some strategies and implement them and see if they had an impact. I am ashamed to say that I want to acknowledge my colleague, Sarah DiBichero, and late last night, I added an H to her name, and I don't know where that came from, but I'll take it back later. She is S-A-R-A, Diva Cheryl, and she's in the audience, and she's the project director, and I thank you very much for all your contributions on this. So, I told you to be forgiving, did I not? Okay. So this project, as I said, was funded under PREA. A few years back now, again, another action research partnership where we come in and we help the practitioners understand the nature of their problems, helping them analyze data, conducting site observations, interviewing staff, and in this case, interviewing inmates as well, and then trying to develop strategies that will help reduce the problems that are of issue. So earlier you saw a very fuzzy matrix of situational crime prevention in general. This is one that's applied specifically to looking at sexual assault, other violence, and also acts of self-harm, which we felt were also important to look at in the jail setting. And just to, you know, to pull out any example, things like double bunking, which could be a precipitator for some kinds of violence in a correctional setting, actually is helpful in reducing acts of self-harm. Or target hardening, locking off risky areas like broom closets, which we found were likely areas of staff sexual misconduct, which is something that we ended up finding in some of our sites. So there, you know, just the different kinds of things that you can do to close off opportunities for these events, even in correctional settings. So what did we do? We had meetings with our three jail sites. We did these site observations where we systematically collected data and all the different characteristics of the facilities, the design, the visibility from where the correction officers sit, the frequency which with they do their rounds, staff perceptions about where the strengths and vulnerabilities are in the facility, interviews with inmates to learn the same from them, analysis of incident data, which of course in the case of sexual assault was not that great, but certainly lots of data on incidents of violence, of contraband, of self-harm. And we took all that information, we synthesized it, and we developed a list of recommendations that stemmed from it. And then we went back to each of our sites, and we said, okay, here's what we found. And, you know, similar to our experience with the study of the car crime and the Metro facility, you know, we have this really long, creative list of things, and then one by one, no, can't do that, no. But we found some interesting things to do in each of the three sites. Here's some overall findings across the three sites. In terms of sexual assault, again, it's just a really murky area. There's no real consensus on how often it happens. We found that because we were doing a lot of qualitative data collection on this, that people would talk about an incident, and we discovered it was the same incident over and over again that everyone was talking about, but it was a sole incident. There were some perceptions about sort of the common victims in terms of males being the stereotypical, you know, younger, weaker, smaller, you know, white males are more likely to be targets. We learned of some sexual harassment issues of female staff by the male inmates. There was talk of some staff sexual misconduct. But no real sexual assault findings. With the suicide and self-harm, there was more to work off of, and a lot of, I think, education that needed to occur, at least in one of our sites, with the staff about, you know, what constitutes a call for help versus an excuse to get out of the cell and how to treat those cases in the proper manner. And then a lot on physical assaults, which are quite common, not in all the facilities. There was quite a bit of variation. But we looked at the type of weapons, the locations, the cause of the fights, whether they were mostly one-on-one or were they group, and so forth. So we came up with a series of recommendations. And as I said before, not all of them were implemented at any one of the three sites. But one that was prominent was this increased monitoring of the inmates. And we also looked at things like changing the classification system, which is what predicted who would be bunked with whom and in what proximity to other people. We looked at access to mental health care, which we found was an issue in one of the facilities. And, you know, then that led to a recommendation for training. But what we're going to talk about today, and then Chief Wilds is going to share her personal experiences with, is this officer tour system that was implemented in the Jacksonville Jail, one of our three study sites. And Chief Wilds, I don't want to steal your thunder. Can I describe your facility? Okay. So it's sort of like the panopticon. Does anyone know? It's not direct supervision, okay? It's like you're in a sort of booth and you can look down on everybody, and you're supposed to get out and make rounds periodically, and that's supposed to be documented. But in interviewing both staff and inmates, we came to learn that that was done on a very inconsistent basis. And we felt like the more the officers were interacting with the inmates, the more they're there, they're going to be increasing the risk of detection, right? But also removing excuses, because they're going to be there to be approached if there's a personal problem that, if not addressed, might lead to self-harm. So there's a lot of reasons why we think that this kind of physical interaction, by ensuring that they're going to be doing their rounds and there physically, could make a difference. And so this was the technology that was selected. It's based on RFID technology, so it's like those cards that you use, proximity cards, to get in and out of buildings. And there's boxes placed periodically around the floor so that you can ensure that the officer, as he or she does the rounds, taps with this blue, what do you call it?
Pipe.
The pipe. They use the pipe and touch the pipe on this and to demonstrate that they've been there physically. And that's about as much as I know about it, and Sarah and Chief Wilds can tell you more because they've seen it implemented and I have not. So what we're doing right now is we're tracking implementation, and that the end of that year, Sarah, is what, September? Yeah, so we're not quite through the year mark on the actual implementation of the intervention. Then we're looking forward to analyzing the impact, but I believe Chief Wilds has some anecdotal evidence to share with us. So I have 3 minutes, and I'm just going to throw out some lessons learned, and then hopefully we'll have time. I know some of you are researchers, some of you are practitioners. You both know the pros and cons of engaging in these kinds of partnerships. They can be really rewarding. They can also be quite challenging. From our perspective as researchers across these three projects, I think that it's real important to find the true champions, people who really embrace research-based practice. And, you know, I think by now I know how to find them, but I don't think I knew a few years ago. There's people who say yes to everything, and then there's people who really mean it. And then you've got to hope that they stick around, because they're the really good ones, and they often end up moving somewhere else. And there's no control over that, and that's one of the reasons why I increasingly think that when we write proposals, Winnie, we should propose more sites than we ever intend on evaluating. We've talked about this before. But more often than not, there's going to be one or two or more sites that just don't get off the ground for reasons that are beyond virtually any single individual's control. Encouraging adherence to the model, the more you do it, the better, because we know that adherence to the model is more likely to yield the desired effect. We do believe that it's important to not just be quantitative in our approach, but also to collect qualitative data, because that kind of context is really important in interpreting our findings. The longer the evaluation period, the better, resources permitting. And then this is my own personal question mark. I always want to isolate what about an intervention makes a difference, but with situational crime prevention, that's sometimes difficult. Sometimes there's multiple interventions. You don't really know what's making the difference, and I'm wondering if I should just stop worrying about that, but maybe we can talk about that later. Thank you for your time.